set about systematically to read and study and meditate and make himself essentially one of the most learned people ever to put pen to ink, or quill to ink, I guess, in his case.
We therefore need to see that what Dante is doing here is trying to come to grips on enormously different levels of reality with exile. Obviously, there's a way in which you come to it theologically. We are all, in a sense, exiles from the promised land of heaven. It becomes a metaphor for the human condition generally. But also, Dante sort of racks his brain to say, what is so unjust about the way we're governing ourselves? And what might we do about this? How can we untangle this maze to try to understand ways that we could live together well? Because Dante understood that the goal of human life was not earthly happiness, but that earthly happiness, A, was important, and B, was a pretty good condition for people, therefore, being able to seek those things that do last beyond the grave. If you're simply grubbing around to survive, and know that the way to survive is by stabbing literally or metaphorically somebody else in the back, you're probably not going to be focusing on those things that last forever.
So when he's reading and studying in his exile, obviously he reads a lot of works that are sort of classic works on politics, but also he goes to others who have either suffered from or written about exile themselves. And it turns out to be a pretty long list of poets, and it also turns out to be the case that he can go to sources like the Bible. And Bill started off by saying that exile really is ultimately kind of spiritual condition and has to do with all of us sort of separated from our home. That's the sort of stuff that Dante began to think about in a way that few others have. And so that when he begins to write the poem, he has not only the experience of exile, the meditation on it in his personal life, but also a huge number of texts at his disposal which deal with that central issue. When we start talking in the next lecture, we'll begin looking at those texts that Dante himself drew upon in his own Commedia.
Lecture 3, Literary Antecedents, Part 1.
At the end of the last lecture, we talked a little bit about Dante as a learned poet, somebody who meditated on and appropriated to himself a number of very, very important texts that really were part of earlier traditions. What we want to do in a somewhat more systematic way today is talk about the way, in fact, that Dante was able to use those texts in the Commedia itself, the way in which he was able to build on what previously existed so that he would be able to deal with issues at a pretty sophisticated level, taking what was already there as a kind of starting point. So what we're going to do is suggest that these other texts really become for him a source of energy, and also help to account for some of the organizational principles of his own poem. And so to do that, we're going to start with the blockbuster of all texts, the text that was most fundamental to the way Dante thought and wrote, and that text, of course, would be the Christian Bible.
First of all, it is hard, I think, even today for Christians to understand how central the Bible was to people in the Middle Ages, because it was not just the source of their religious ideas, of their organization of their churches and whatever, but it was a mine in which one could find valuable stuff about every conceivable subject. Obviously, things related to purely religious and theological things, such as ethics, but also politics, raising your child, or whatever it might be, the Bible was seen as a source of a different kind than all other sources. It didn't block out the value of non-biblical, non-Judeo-Christian text, but everything was in some ways seen through the prism of the Bible's standards. And therefore, we need to start with this extraordinary thing. Of course, one of the difficulties in talking about the Bible is it isn't a book. That is to say, it's a collection, an anthology of Hebrew literature and the earliest Christian literature. And today, a lot of modern scholarship emphasizes the different origins of books or parts of books and recreates the historical context in which Isaiah wrote or the evangelist John wrote or whatever it might be. And that's all well and good. Dante would not have known a lot of that stuff or probably cared very much about that sort of stuff that we call a lot of biblical scholarship today. Rather, the Bible was a book of life. It was a story. It was a story that had a beginning and a story that had an end. It had huge narrative pieces, but also beautiful poetry. It was a literary model as well as a book of information and a guide. And I think we need to have that comprehensive understanding of the Bible before we can see what it is that Dante is going to do with those texts.
I want to add to what Bill said in terms of the importance of the Bible, again, by suggesting some differences between the way it's looked on now and the way it was looked at back then. It's important to see this not simply as a book or even a collection of books, although it was that, but that those books themselves were seen to be a record of acts, that is to say, the action of God working in history. As Bill suggested, it had a plot, okay, and that plot, to be a little bit more specific, goes from creation all the way to last judgment. And so somebody looking at that book would see all of human history contained in it, and therefore see oneself implicated in that story. In other words, you look at the Bible and you say, yeah, that tells us about how God acted in history, but it's also telling us about how he acts in history. And as such, part of what we have to do is learn how to read it appropriately so that we can learn how to see the meaning in history, the meaning of our own life, the meaning of our own actions. Okay? So it's important, again, to kind of try and develop this medieval mindset when we think about the way in which Dante mined the Bible.
In other words, I think what Ron's suggesting, if I can sort of build on his thoughts, is that today it's easy to look at the Bible as a historical record of a people who lived a long time ago, that the last dot was put on the last sentence of the Bible, you know, 1900 plus years ago, perhaps. And therefore, it seems very different from the world we inhabit. It seems like a strange place, if you will, this biblical world, just as ancient history seems like a strange place. And obviously today, one of the things that sermons do, for example, is try to bridge that gap. In many ways, in the Middle Ages, it was a much more systematic enterprise. First of all, they didn't believe there was nearly as big a gap to bridge. But secondly, there was this constant dialogue, conscious dialogue, between the past and the present. Not what did the Bible mean for those folks, what does it mean for me? Not just in terms of general ideas or an occasional favorite story to draw a moral from, but as Dante later on himself, line by line by line, what did this mean then? What does this mean now? What will this mean for our future, which also, again, is going somewhere toward an end that is described prophetically at the end of the Bible in the book of Revelation?
Another way that they looked at the Bible, they were pretty clear about the fact that God wrote it. They were not literalists or fundamentalists, or perhaps would be a better term, as we sometimes suspect they were. But the fact is, they were convinced that these scriptures were sacred, they were authored by God, and that this showed God's workings in history in the same way that God's other book did, which was the universe itself. In other words, that sense of creation, since we are created and since there is a creator, one of the very best images they had to sort of think about that process was that creation was like a book authored by God. And that sort of set the relationship right for them. Well, if creation was, if you will, God's first book, the Bible turned out to be not only his second and parallel book, but as many thinkers in the Middle Ages put it, it was the interpretive key to his first book. In other words, one reads the Bible in order to discover things about the first book authored by God, about the universe itself. So again, this sense of the Bible as a source, we need to start with all of these things that give it a place that, as Bill put it at the very beginning of this lecture, very difficult for us to relate to because of modern ways that we have of looking at this text.
Let me illustrate this with beginning with a story everybody's familiar with, the story of creation in Genesis. I think this is a way that medieval people would look at that story. First of all, it says that humans are created in the image of God. Therefore, the more you know about God, the more you know about humans. After all, it doesn't make any sense to say I can understand the image of God without understanding what it is that's being imaged. A second thing is that in that same creation story in Genesis, God gives certain commands to humans, and he gives them certain things that other people don't have, or other creatures don't have. So people can talk, for example, while other creatures can't. So God endows them with certain gifts and then says, go out and use those gifts in imitation of me. Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over, and so on and so forth. And so, if you will, what humans are and what humans image is all laid out at the beginning. And every word of the Bible, quite literally, was seen, therefore, to be a guide to knowing God and therefore also a guide to human conduct.
Okay, so we've established the importance of the text. What we need to talk about next is how they went about reading it. Given its importance, they spent a lot of time saying, well, there are good ways to read it and not so good. What are the best ways? They were very concerned about the fact that the Bible, you open it, it's divided into two parts, the Old Testament, which is the story of a people chosen by God, as the story goes, the Hebrews, right? And that story is given right from the time of Abraham all the way through the ups and downs of their history. But if you want the continuation of that story in the New Testament, then it kind of changes focus a little bit and talks about the impact of one particular Hebrew, Jesus Christ. And so you have this stark division, really, between Old and New Testament. One of the issues that they had to deal with in a very explicit way is what is the relationship between these two different bodies of literature, written at different times, written in different languages, Old Testament originally written in Hebrew, New Testament originally written in Greek, and in fact seeming to deal with different things. Is there a way to make sure that we see some kind of continuity, some kind of connection between these two parts of the Bible?
Another way to put it is something like this, that you've got the Old Testament with all of these stories and laws and rules and regulations, clearly it is sacred scripture for Christians, and clearly Christians are to be guided by it. On the other hand, there are many specific parts of the Old Testament that Christians regard as not binding. For example, Christians don't practice the dietary regulations of Jews, nor are they circumcised, at least by religious ritual. And so, how do you deal with this body of literature that A, is sacred, is the writing of God, and B, is problematic given the way Christians live and even given some of the things that New Testament writers say?
Well, one of the ways they looked at it is by saying, what's the most central thing that happens in this story that begins with creation and that ends with the last judgment at the end of time? To Christians, it was God entering the world in the form of Jesus Christ, God's Son. Well, what they did was say, well, how are we going to take that and look at the previous history of the Hebrews, and how are we going to see that previous history in relation to this event? What they did was say, there is a relationship, and the relationship is as follows. Those events that took place in the Old Testament, they are, for the most part, historically true. They are important to know and understand in and of themselves, but they are not complete in themselves because we don't really know what the story means, what the full story means, until we see how they are related to those events that connect with the life of Christ in the new. In other words, what they did was develop, in a fairly systematic way, a relationship between people and events in the old and the person and the events in the life of Christ in the new. And systematically studying and exploring that relationship turns out to be a large part of what occupied the mind of biblical, what we would call biblical scholars, of people who wrote and commented about the Bible in the Middle Ages.
That word systematic that Ron used is really clear, because in the New Testament itself, there are suggestions of this. Paul talks about all the prophets really talking about Jesus. John talks about that the real bread of life is not the manna in the desert, but is Jesus coming down from heaven. What happens in the centuries just before and Dante's own century is the attempt to make this systematic, line by line, correspondence by correspondence. You'll see, for example, paintings or stained glass windows in which you'll have a whole strip of Old Testament stories, and then right next to them, usually with some sort of visual connection, you will see their New Testament analogs or New Testament fulfillments, so that it does become a kind of system. And Dante, we don't know quite how his education all unfolded, really was deeply initiated into not just the idea of doing this, but the system and the thoroughness of doing it line by line, story by story.
So, again, to use a couple of specific examples from biblical exegesis, that will set us up to sort of moving to see the way Dante does it. What they did was take a look at a very important figure, let's say, in Hebrew scripture, like King David, say that, well, if you look at David in the various roles that he plays as king, as shepherd, somebody who is very important in the development of the Hebrew sense of their own identity, those same attributes were given to Jesus, who was seen to be a king in the line of David. And so if you look at what you have with the story of David from this perspective, you say that everything that you see about him in Hebrew scripture is real and important, but it's not the whole story. You have to know how the story comes out before you can see the way that works.
One illustration that is often given to sort of begin our discussion of this is to say, well, we've got the story of Jonah and the whale, a famous story from the book of the prophet Jonah. And the whale, or the fish, swallowed Jonah, and 3 days later he spit up on the shore. Well, there's a clue even in the New Testament that says this is linked to Jesus. Just as Jonah was in the belly of the whale and came out, so was Jesus in the belly of the earth in the grave, and then he came out on the third day as well. And so that's the kind of way that we find these very specific connections all the way through. You'll find pictures in the Middle Ages, again in stained glass windows, of the resurrection over here, and here's Jonah climbing out of a big fish right over here. We need to understand one in terms of the other. The Jonah story is not complete without the Jesus story, and the Jesus story is better understood if you have the Jonah antecedent.
Well, what we're going to do now is make the outrageous case that Dante writes his own poem in imitation of the Bible. Not simply that he uses stories from the Bible, which he does, not simply that he uses characters from the Bible, which he does. The pilgrim is going to meet a bunch of them and chat with them even in some cases. Not simply that he gives the Bible this special place, but he's writing in imitation of the Bible in the fundamental sense that just as the Bible proceeds according to this typological way in which an event is related to other events and can't really be understood except in terms of those other events, so also with his poem, that one way to state it is that you can't really understand anything that happens in the beginning of the poem, let's say in the first part, in the Inferno, without fully understanding what comes next in the Purgatorio and in the Paradiso. that there are events and characters in the latter parts of the poem which refer back to and complete things that happen earlier on.
Dante has a number of ways of helping us to do that. The mistake a lot of readers make, I think, especially those who only read the Inferno, is assuming that if they've read the Inferno, they've really got down Dante's point of view, his understanding of everything. They know what he thinks about this political issue or this moral issue or whatever. And of course, what they miss is exactly what Ron's describing. Because just as in Scripture, the same issues, if you will, come up again and again and again and again, and we get a number of different ways to look at them, either within the Old Testament or within the New Testament or between the two Testaments, so similarly do we really need to get to the end. In fact, one of the great lines of Dante scholarship is, when you finish reading the poem, you're ready to read the poem.
And another one of the lines is that Dante expects us to take this poem as though it had the same kind of historical reality that Scripture does. Think about that for a minute. As we said earlier, one of the things that made Scripture so important was that for the Christian, it was the record of God's actions in history. Okay, that it was not a text self-contained, but it was this text that spoke to and about actions that really happened. Now, most of us don't believe that Dante really did take this trip to the afterlife. All right, there are some exceptions to that. I was reading an essay by somebody the other day who said she was, in fact, taught by somebody who believed fully that Dante really did take that trip. I guess you're allowed to do that, and at some of our more extravagant moments, we're very sympathetic to that perspective. But for the most part, we think that this is a fiction that Dante invented about the journey of a character named Dante to the afterlife. But in one of the great one-liners of Dante criticism and scholarship of the 20th century, the great fiction of the poem is that it's not a fiction. That is to say that Dante wants us to take it with the same kind of seriousness as we would take biblical events that really did happen. In other words, to suspend our disbelief and to see Dante the pilgrim on this journey, okay, to the afterlife, and to see that this journey is modeled on that movement from creation to judgment that's in Scripture, or some of the other important journey motifs in Scripture, perhaps most important, that of the Exodus.
If we now turn to some specific parts of the Old Testament, especially because they're perhaps less obviously applicable to a Dante who is a Christian than the New Testament text, the best place to start is the Exodus. This story that really takes up four books of the Old Testament and is referred to constantly and retold in the Psalms and other places. It's, of course, in a literal sense, the journey of the Hebrews from Egypt to Palestine. They get out by going through the Red Sea. They get into Palestine by going through the Jordan. But as soon as we say that, we've only begun the story of the Exodus, as we know today as Americans. We know, for example, how black slaves in the South used the story of the Exodus and not only saw it as an allegory, but also sometimes as almost literally a guide to the Ohio River. So that we find, too, in Dante, it's not just a story, although it is that. It is also the journey from exile to homeland, from bondage to freedom, from death to life. It is the paradigmatic story of the Hebrews, and Dante fully understands and uses it.
So, just to sort of piggyback on that, or to apply Exodus to the poem, it makes sense. It really is a good way to look at the poem, to see the Inferno as equivalent to the bondage of Egypt, the Purgatorio as the wandering in the desert, the Paradiso as reaching the promised land. It's also equally important to say, well, really what it's about is this physical, actual geography, but it's also about this internal turn from slavery to freedom. And so, as far as Dante the Pilgrim himself is concerned, the Exodus provides the model from slavery to freedom. Okay? Dante writes a poem about a guy named Dante who starts out dumb and who ends up smart. But It's not dumb and smart in simply intellectual or a cognitive sense. It's spiritually dumb ending up spiritually smart, or spiritually enslaved and ends up spiritually free. So that the whole Exodus motif deals with the poem that he set up, but also, and perhaps even more important, the nature of the journey that he's taking. Dante is, in his own life, in the poem, reenacting the Exodus.
We also want to turn to another hunk of the Old Testament for its particular importance to Dante, and that is the 22 books that are labeled the prophetic books, in particular the 16 books that we call the writing prophets. Now, today, sometimes we have a debased notion of what prophecy means, reading tea leaves or whatever. But my one-liner about Old Testament prophets would be this. Although they are dramatically and intensely concerned with the future, they are deeply, deeply rooted in their past. In other words, if you will, God has a track record. They are very, very careful observers of the present. And only when they've done those things do they really talk in ways that are powerful about the future. It's not guessing. It's not tea leaves. It is prophet who is A, rooted in past, careful observer of present, and therefore can talk intelligently and powerfully about the future.
Now notice that in many examples of prophecy in Hebrew Scripture in the Old Testament, one of the things that enables them to do it, okay, is that they're given some kind of God's eye view of things, and they're able to immerse themselves in the present through the past, and therefore it's almost as though the future is part of this whole continuum. Well, if you begin thinking about that in terms of Dante, it's sort of interesting to see how Dante himself, of course, has this God's eye view of things, because he is taking a journey to realms of experience that are not usually allotted to us on this in this life. Okay, he goes to the three parts of the afterlife. Well, that gives him a perspective that others don't have. It enables him to see what others don't see. But of course, he takes that perspective and applies it exactly in the manner of the Old Testament prophets to the events of the present time. And so I think the case that we want to make as strongly as possible is that Dante acts as a kind of prophetic commentator on the events of his own time, even as he's very interested in other events and other times, that he wants us, in other words, to see him incorporating the spirit of biblical prophecy into the Commedia itself.
And I think we can sort of end this section by saying just a couple other things. First of all, you know, today one of the phrases we use for prophets is they speak truth to power. That Dante has to learn, if he's going to himself speak prophetically, that you have to tell the truth no matter who it might hurt. You've got to tell the truth no matter how much damage the people you tell the truth about can do to you. And that's a very tough lesson. And Dante not only needs to learn that in the abstract, he learns it from the prophets in the concrete. Just follow the story of Jeremiah. He's booted around, he's arrested, he's thrown in a hole because he doesn't have a lot of good news, and kings don't like not good news. And so Dante can not only model prophecy as a form of speaking, he can also model the prophet's life in his own exile and the experience of exile.
So essentially, it's the exile that demands that he begin thinking about things as a prophet would, and that means that his job is to speak to power and to speak to the abuses of power. Well, where does he do that? In the poem itself. One very important way of taking a look at the Divine Comedy is that it is meant to speak to power and to talk about the abuses of power. And like Jeremiah and the other Old Testament prophets, Dante is somebody who comes to this through the experience of exile. That exile, too, was the condition which Jeremiah and the other prophets had to face. And so Dante is saying, well, this condition can be a way of speaking truth to power without regard to the consequences. One way to take a look at that, Dante is able to write the poem from the point of view of somebody who doesn't have a whole heck of a lot more to lose. Okay, he can afford to speak the truth. So that prophetic strain is something that we would say is deep and consistent throughout the entire Commedia.
And while we will argue that if you have to say, pick out one text from the past and put them all in order, which one did Dante use the most or value the most? I think we'd both agree it's the Bible, but it's not the only text. Because Dante, like the Middle Ages in general, is the heir also of the classical tradition, the Greek and Roman tradition, with its myths, with its philosophy, with its literature, with its history. And therefore, we want to turn now, at the end of this lecture, and continue into the next lecture, saying a little bit about one classical figure of paramount importance, one that strikes us right in Canto 1, because the first person we really meet, other than Dante the Pilgrim himself, is in fact not a Christian, not a biblical figure, but a figure from classical antiquity, a poet named Virgil.
Virgil shows up very early in the poem. He stays for quite a long time. It turns out that Virgil is Dante's guide for fully two-thirds of the poem. He gives way to Beatrice. You remember we mentioned her in the first lecture as the sort of subject for Dante's early love poetry. Virgil gives way only at the very end of the Purgatorio. So for two-thirds of the poem, he is the one who guides Dante through the afterlife. And it turns out that, not surprisingly, his great epic poem, the Aeneid, was a model for Dante in constructing his own poem, a source for a great many of what is in for great many of the episodes that are in Dante's poem, as well as a great many of the characters who are in the poem, and also occasionally a kind of rival to Dante, in the sense that there are things in Virgil that Dante thinks about and that Dante sort of works on and that Dante redoes and rewrites. And he's sort of not satisfied with the answers that Virgil comes up with in his own poem. So one of the things that I think we would like to come away with in this lecture is the sense that even though the influence of the Bible is clearly paramount to Dante, that Virgil represents something that balances it in a way, that Virgil and the way in which the Aeneid is used in the poem has the same kind of generating and generative force in the poem that the Bible does.
Perhaps it's worthwhile to just remind ourselves of a little bit of history. Virgil was born in 70 BC in what we would call the late Roman Republic, and he died in 19 BC during the reign of the Emperor Augustus. And this great poem, the Aeneid, he wrote things other than the Aeneid, is in fact the story of the founding of Rome, beginning with the fall of Troy and ending with Aeneas coming to Italy and sort of winning the battles that needed to be won to establish Trojan blood in Italy once and for all. The story itself is important. The episodes and the characters of it are perhaps even more important for what Dante is going to be doing in the Commedia.
And so that's where we will pick it up with the next lecture.
Lecture 4, Literary Antecedents, Part 2.
The story of Troy and its fall is one of the most famous stories in all of Western literature. Most of us first engaged it by reading the Iliad and or the Odyssey of Homer. It's important to say that Dante had not read those poems because they did not exist in a translation into a language, Latin for example, that Dante could read. He knew the plots, but he had not read Homer. And therefore, we need to remember that for Dante, first and foremost, the story of the fall of Troy is a story that's recorded in the great epic poem of the Latin tradition, Virgil's Aeneid. And therefore, going back and claiming all that story, as well as the artistry of Virgil as his own, is an important element in understanding how Dante came to write this poem.
And I guess we would argue that going back to Troy for Dante, going back to what for him was the source of many important things in his worldview, is, while not as important as going back to the Bible, meant to be seen almost on equal footing with it. So we're suggesting then that the Aeneid contains both political and perhaps even personal concerns that are central to Dante in the Commedia. Now, what we're going to do is sort of talk a little bit about them in specific terms, keeping in mind always that we're going to be leaving a lot out. This was a poem that Dante knew probably for the most part by heart. And again, as we talked earlier with biblical, with sort of Dante's knowledge of the biblical tradition, the fact that Dante knew the Bible in a way and at a depth that is foreign to us in our own time, equally true with the classical tradition. He knew Virgil, and he knew Virgil's poem, the Aeneid, in a way that would be sort of astonishing to us. So we're going to talk a little bit first about Troy and what that would mean to Dante. First of all, the most important thing to say for him was that the story of Troy for Dante was about the seed of Roman history, and Roman history turns out to be Dante's own history.
We need to ask why. First of all, remember that Dante lives in Italy. But more than that, Dante looks back to the days of the Roman Empire, when Virgil writes his poem, among other things, as a time when the world really was well-governed. Because for Dante, when you had a world empire, for Dante, essentially the Roman Empire was a world empire, when you have a world empire, it provides the opportunity for greater justice, less competition. Again, remember, in Florence, the big issue is competition. The city-states around Florence, the issue is competition. How do you eliminate the downside of competition? Well, Dante believed in the idea of Rome, and that the Roman Empire was itself a model from the past, a model that had a great deal to say to the present. But that's only half the story, maybe even a little bit less than half. Because while today we might say the fact that the Roman Catholic Church has its headquarters in Rome is essentially accidental, for Dante it was providential. There's no accidental nature to the fact that on the one hand, Rome was the center of empire, and on the other hand, Rome was the center of church. That God chose Rome for these dual roles. And in Dante's own day, the Roman Empire emperors, now living in Germany, had abandoned Rome, and the popes were perverting what their job was in Rome. And so when Dante looks back, he goes all the way back to creation in the Bible, to the creation of Rome, and that story is the Aeneid story.
And of course, it starts really in Book 2 of the Aeneid when we see that the destruction of Troy, the story of the Trojan horse, the burning of Troy, the successful attempt of Aeneas and some of his followers to leave Troy, that's the beginning of a journey that goes all the way to the founding of Rome, but for Dante would not end with the founding of Rome. It's the empire and it's the church. So that in a very real way, what we see in the story of Book 2 of the Aeneid is the seed of Dante's own history, a story that continues down to his own day. And not surprisingly, a great number of the characters from Book 2 of the Aeneid emerge from time to time as characters in the Commedia. But of course, in the background is always the journey of Aeneas himself, that if he is making this journey from Troy to what ultimately is going to become Rome, he's going in the direction of empire from east to west. He's going from defeat to victory. He's going from tragic loss to new land. In some ways, that too becomes a parallel for Dante's own journey in the afterlife through hell and purgatory in heaven. In other words, it becomes a kind of classical, we would use the word, I'm not sure Dante would, secular analog of the Exodus story. And so in some ways, we have to see that Dante's journey piggybacks onto the journey of Aeneas and can't be really understood without understanding that other journey.
It was a rough journey. It was a tough journey. And it was a journey in which there were also some sidetracking. It isn't that the Aeneas made a beeline from Troy to Italy. It was, in many ways, morally, physically, and in other ways, a rocky road, just as the Hebrews wandered for 40 years in the desert before they crossed the Jordan and entered the Promised Land. So the parallels, although not exact, are very important. And the more we abstract the story, the more clear the parallels become.
And if we're talking about sidetracking, the most important of those sidetracks, it seems to me, is the story of Aeneas and Dido that takes place in Book 4 for the most part, but is also throughout much of the rest of the Aeneid as well. It's a love story which Virgil's audience would have seen as something that helped to define what it means to be a Roman. Basically, Dido and Aeneas meet in Carthage. They fall in love, sort of a euphemistic term for what they do. They horse around for a while. Aeneas is visited by Mercury, who says, can't do this. Remember, you've got this duty, this mission. And so he leaves because he realizes that it's important for him to subordinate his own personal desires, to subordinate his sort of hanky-panky with Dido to his greater duty. So that it becomes this story of duty winning out over passion. And as such, it becomes a story which essentially spoke to the Romans' own sense of duty, own sense of what it means, what it is needed, what's necessary to run an empire. But it also becomes a story that continues in its afterlife as others sort of pick it up and use it again and again. And in particular, in Dante's own Commedia, we have already mentioned that Aeneas is a character, but so also is Dido herself. We see her as one of the sinners in Inferno among the lustful. And her sin, like the others who were there, is that she was somebody who submitted reason to desire. Now, a couple things are interesting about that. First of all, it means that Dante actually gave Dido a little bit of a different place in the afterlife than what she had in Virgil's poem. She's in the afterlife in Virgil's poem, but basically in a better place with her first husband. Dante is not afraid to put her among those who are punished in the circle of the lustful. And I want to use this example just simply to point out that Dante is not afraid to revise Virgil and revise Virgil's poem when it suits his own purposes. That is to say, when what he has done is sort of come to a place where he and Virgil disagree. So he's aware of the story of Dido and Aeneas, and he uses it there, but he also uses it when he tells the story of Dante and Beatrice. In other words, one way to take a look at what happens in the Dante-Beatrice story is to see this as sort of Dante's rewriting, in a very broad sense, of the story of Aeneas and Dido. That is to say, if you look at the story as Virgil tells it, one of the hard lessons that Virgil is teaching here is that somehow passionate love and duty are not really compatible. You can have one, you can have the other, you can't have both. Dante, at least in the story of himself, the pilgrim, and Beatrice, is an attempt, I think, for him to re-explore that possibility, to possibly rewrite the ending. And you see, therefore, that Dante is not simply using the specific characters in a narrow sense, but the larger idea that's represented by the story in a larger sense.
It's worthwhile also saying this about Dido. We haven't really introduced you to her and said who she is. She turns out to be the Queen of Carthage, which is, again, an independent nation at the time this story is allegedly set. And you need to know a couple things about her. First of all, queens have obligations. She's in charge of the country. Secondly, her first husband has died, and she took an oath not to be unfaithful, to be, in fact, faithful to the ashes of her husband, Sichaeus. And so she doesn't come to us with a blank slate. She comes with a story and a set of obligations. And as Virgil tells the story of Dido and Aeneas sort of romping around for a while, he stops and gives us a glimpse of the city of Carthage. And he says, you know, nobody is manning the towers of the city. Nobody is repairing the walls of the city. That's, after all, something that the queen does. And so even though Dido and Aeneas are having a good old time, the fact is she has duties too. And she's unfaithful to those obligations, and the consequences are extraordinary. They're extraordinary to the city of Carthage. And they are extraordinary to her, because when Aeneas listens to Mercury and heads off to Italy, Dido commits suicide. And therefore, we see this tragedy that seems to have begun with a kind of love passion that has been damaging to the individual involved and to the city of Carthage.
Now, notice in that, what Virgil is trying to do, of course, is contrast Dido with Aeneas. They both make mistakes. Dido doesn't quite know how to recover and kills herself out of passion and actually passion and hatred. Aeneas's ability to recover after his mistakes sort of sets up another way in which he's a model for Dante's journey. Because, of course, Dante's journey starts when he is lost in a dark wood. And the whole process, really, of his development in the poem is learning how to get out of that dark wood, which I think is very much related to this notion of learning how to recover from mistakes that you have already made.
Perhaps the part of the Aeneid that is most directly applied by Dante in the Commedia is the journey that Aeneas takes in Book 6. Because in Book 6, Aeneas goes to the underworld, and he meets the shades of those who have died. Dido, as Ron suggested, among them. And while he is there, he not only gets to chat with some folks who have been dead, but he also gets to hear words that tell about Rome's destiny and Rome's greatness. It brings the past and the future together as he journeys to the underworld. As Dante says at the beginning of Inferno 2, when Virgil proposes to him, let's go to the underworld, one of Dante's first reactions is, wait a minute, I know Aeneas did that, but I'm not Aeneas. As Ron has already hinted, in some ways, Dante does become Aeneas.
It's interesting also in that regard. We've talked a little bit then about, you know, major episodes in the Aeneid, the fall of Troy, the hanky-panky with Dido, the trip to the underworld. The trip to the underworld is the one that really gets the double asterisk mark of approval here, because if you go back to the central question, why is it that Virgil is the one who guides Dante through two-thirds of the poem? One answer is, he's a guy who knows the territory. That is to say, through his writing about the underworld, he has kind of staked out a claim to be Dante's guide. You want somebody who knows the territory, who better than this guy who has described it imaginatively in Book 6 of the Aeneid. And in fact, if you take a look at that Book 6 with some care, you see that a great deal of the geography that Virgil invents, really, turns out to be geography that Dante himself uses in the Inferno. That he is somebody who borrows pretty massively from Virgil at that point. So also, it's interesting that there is this sense, it's not developed with any degree of exactness, but there's this sense in Book 6 of the Aeneid that folks get the kind of afterlife that they deserve. And we think of that, you know, in terms of Dante's incorporation into his poem as something that came from the Christian tradition, but in fact, Dante was able to get something like that from the classical tradition as well. And so Virgil becomes this figure of overwhelming importance because of what Virgil already achieved.
So as we journey down into hell, we're going to cross strangely named rivers. We're going to meet some folks. And we're going to understand a lot of that geography specifically because it's borrowed from the Aeneid 6. If you want, other than looking at a drawing of hell in a translation of Dante, if you want a glimpse of something that'll give you a kind of roadmap, inexact though it may be, do a little Virgil review before you take your journey by reading Dante's Inferno. And it will pay off, if nothing else, simply in the way that as you read the notes then that accompany your translation, they'll make a lot more sense. You will have something to grab a hold of, and you'll be able to see how much Dante draws from this Virgilian description of the afterlife.
To sum up, one of the things that's very interesting about Aeneas's own trip is that he takes this journey to the underworld because he wants to see his father, who is there, this great act of loyalty, but also because he needs an answer to why he should continue, why he should go on. That in Aeneas, you have somebody for whom life has not been a walk in the park. He has lost his wife. He has lost his city. He's in exile. He's going from place to place, blown ashore, losing men, losing his father. And this sense of why go on seems to become more and more of a question for him. Going down to the underworld, he gets to see a picture of Roman greatness that allows him to continue because it basically says, look, you're the one who can bring this about. Or if you don't continue, this greatness is never going to take place. So he comes out from the underworld with a renewed sense of vocation, if you will. Notice that if you apply that general idea to the Commedia, it works very well. Dante takes the trip to the afterlife to figure out what it's all about, okay, in the terms that we've been using to get him out of this dark wood of error that he's in. And so that, like Virgil, he's got to go down so that he can come up. And again, something that fits very nicely in the Christian tradition also has this classical analog.
And as a final illustration of a point we've made before and we'll make again and again as we walk through and journey with Dante in the Commedia is that, for example, Dante does meet his ancestor in the afterlife and have a very long conversation and find out why he has to go back after this journey and do something important. But he doesn't meet him in hell. Doesn't meet him in purgatory. He meets him in heaven. You'd never have a feel for that part of the Virgilian parallel if you only read the Inferno. We've got to go all the way through because it's only in heaven that Dante has a sort of parallel conversation with his ancestor, in this case not his father, but his great-great-grandfather.
We're going to just shift gears slightly now and talk about a third influence, the Bible, Virgil, and now a text written by St. Augustine called the Confessions, which also is very important in giving you a feel for how Dante uses previous literary text. Confessions written by St. Augustine, and before we tell you a little bit about the text, maybe we need to tell you a little bit about Augustine himself.
St. Augustine was born in North Africa in 354. At about the time Christianity is in a transitional period from a persecuted religion to the dominant religion of the Roman Empire. In fact, his own family sort of personifies that struggle. One parent was pagan, one parent was Christian. That at the age of about 31, after many years of struggle, Augustine converted to Christianity in Italy. By this time, he had come to Italy, and in fact, that conversion and his baptism took place in Milan. Shortly after that time, he went back to North Africa, where he became the bishop of the city of Hippo, which is in modern Algeria, and there he died in the year 430. He was one of the most voluminous authors in the entire history of Christianity, writing sermons and letters and biblical commentaries and a 1,000-page book called The City of God, all of which are vitally important and were well known in the Middle Ages as well as now. But especially for the purposes of the Commedia, the work that is most personal and immediate to Dante is this story of his own life up through his conversion, a story that is called The Confessions, written when he was in his mid-40s, that is to say, basically a decade after his conversion.
Well, first of all, it's important to just sort of stake out the obvious similarity, and that is that Augustine, in writing the Confessions, is writing about himself. In the previous epic literary tradition, we have Virgil writing about Aeneas. Bill talked a little bit about Homer. Homer writes about Achilles, and he writes about Odysseus. And what you have in Dante is writing a poem in that same epic tradition, but the hero of Dante's poem is Dante. Okay? The Dante pilgrim is sort of modeled on the Augustine who is the subject of the Confessions, even as Augustine, the converted bishop, looks back at his early life and tells us about it. You have the poet telling us about this Dante of 1300, even though the poet himself is living and writing at a much later time. So the idea of writing about the self and writing about the self in terms of a kind of spiritual autobiography turns out to be extremely important in the Commedia. Among the other things that we can say about it, what is this work? What is this great epic that Dante writes? It is a spiritual autobiography.
And I would describe the narrative part, it's not all 13 books are narrative, but I would describe the narrative part as beginning with the problem, what I would call the miseducation of Augustine, both in school and from his parents. And then when Augustine decides at about the age of 18 to get serious about life, to learn and to seek things beyond immediate physical gratification, boy, is that hard. He's got a lot to unlearn as well as a lot to learn. And even as he grows in his struggle, he falls back from time to time. Even as he grows in his struggle, it is very hard to get rid of those old habits that have simply become a part of who he is. And so in several books, I would say books 3 to 7 of the Confessions, we struggle for Augustine to really understand well enough. But we all know that understanding isn't enough. You ask people, did you know you were doing something wrong? And most of the time they say yes. The problem is not of intellect. The problem is will. And therefore, in this most beautiful book for me of the Confessions, the 8th book, we have the struggle where Augustine is fighting the fact that he knows what he should do, but can't choose it because it means leaving so many things that have given him pleasure behind. And as it leads to its dramatic conclusion at the end of book 8, he's in a garden under a tree. He's called to pick up a book. He picks up the words of St. Paul in the letter to the Romans. Hears the call to put away nature and nature's appetite and rely on God. Doesn't have to read beyond that. He puts the book down. He gets filled full of confidence. He has, in fact, made his choice. And think about that in parallel to Dante. Being really confused, struggling to learn things you need to learn and unlearn things that need to be unlearned, and then finally coming to this dramatic choice and ultimately making that choice.
It's also interesting that Augustine tells the story of his own conversion. We might ask, well, before he was a Christian, what was he? He was, I guess, a kind of pagan, and he was somebody who was educated in the pagan classics, in classical literature in particular. His profession, he was a professor of rhetoric. I guess the equivalent would be he would be teaching at Harvard Law School if he were alive and well now. And what he grew up with were the great works of classical literature. And at a certain point, he says, you know, what I need to do is find truth, and I'm not getting it there. And so the Confessions turns out to be this intense search for truth, which ultimately leads to Christianity. But before he gets there, he says, tried a lot of things, didn't work, found something that was really very helpful. In book 7 of the Confessions, he talks about finding the Platonist philosophers, as he calls them. Okay, philosophers in the Greek tradition following Plato who taught him basic truths that were necessary for his conversion to Christianity. So Augustine becomes a model of somebody who is of two traditions, really, of the classical and of the biblical or Christian. And the Confessions is an attempt to sort of see how these works fit together. And in exactly the same way, you could argue that the Commedia is an attempt to see how the classical and the Christian traditions fit together. Dante, who is inspired and energized by the Bible, but for whom Virgil is the guide, Virgil operates for Dante in much the same way that the Platonist philosophers are a guide to Augustine.
I would also make the point that, just as Ron has pointed out, that Dante does not hesitate to fix up or correct Virgil in some ways. So I think that is true with Augustine, in this sense in particular. When Augustine is writing, various kinds of pagan theologies and philosophies were real alternatives to people. That is to say, in fact, probably Christians were barely a majority, if that, during most of Augustine's life. There were other real alternatives. And